Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Last week, when we had State Representatives Teresa Wood and Tom Stevens on, we discussed school funding, and there was a mention of per pupil waiting. School funding is never the easiest subject to understand, and rather than let that subject go unexplained, I've invited a member of the per pupil waiting task force that was just named and will be working this summer on the subject onto the show, and that is Representative Peter Conlon of Cornwall. He's one of four House members on the committee, along with four state senators. He joins us now to discuss this issue. Representative Conlon, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I've got to learn to say it first. What exactly, Representative Conlon, is per pupil waiting?
Well, we are going to be spending some time in the weeds here about how education funding works. And one of the key figures in how we sort of distribute state funding for education is equalized pupils. So we basically take our big pot of money and distribute it to school districts based on equalized pupils. Now, an equalized pupil is different than a regular pupil because it has a weight applied to it. So that's really meant to reflect sort of the cost differences in providing education. So, for example, we count English language learners as more than one to reflect the fact that it costs extra to provide the services for English language learners.
Mm-hmm.
We do the same for secondary grade 7 through 12 students. They're counted as a little bit more than one. We do the same for students who come from economically deprived backgrounds. We count them as more than one. And again, it is to really reflect that these students cost more to educate for, you know, if you take secondary students, they're generally offered more classes. Many of those classes are smaller, more specialized. So that could be one cost difference. English language learners obviously need additional services to provide language instruction, and so forth. But the numbers that we currently use for weighting are at least 20 years old. Ooh. Nobody really knows where the numbers came from for this, how we weight these students. And so it was decided in a few years ago, by 2018, we voted to commission a report looking at the current weights that we use in Vermont for students and see if they needed to be revamped. And then that study was done by a team of researchers led by Tammy Colby at the University of Vermont, and they issued a report that the legislature took up starting in January 2020. And with so much going on, we finally have put together a task force to really look at the weights and really talk about proposed legislation that would incorporate them, especially into how we calculate equalized pupils.
In the current system, which, as you said, is at least 20 years old, how heavily do things get weighted, like English language learners or someone from, the poverty level, for a student who, you know, is in the poverty level?
Well, it's, not as much as the new report shows that they should be. So, for example, I think a student from an economically deprived background is counted at 1.25, or maybe as an English language learner. I can't quite keep all the current numbers straight, but really the highest we go is about 1.25. Now, it's a little more complicated than that because, you know, if you're an English language learner who's also from an economically deprived background, you add the two, there's it's a complex formula to get to where you're going. But the recommendations provided in this study that was done would really change these numbers pretty dramatically.
And so let's just use an example of an English language learner, and let's say that now is currently weighted at 1.25. The new system, and I know you haven't met and you haven't determined this, but how much different are you considering that would be weighted?
Well, so the study that was presented to us would take that and increase it to 2.58. And so, you know, that's a significant change.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think what's important to point out is that what this whole system would really do, making changes to it, and what it's designed to do, is to divide the pie, the education fund. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about necessarily changing how much we spend on education,
right,
but really changing how that funding is divided among all the school districts.
Right. And so a school that has more students who require more of these services would get more, in theory, a larger slice of the pie than those that don't have as many of these equalized pupils with higher scores.
Yeah, well, I'll sort of redefine that a little better, but it's easier for folks to understand that it's about funding, but what it really is about taxing capacity. So, you know, a school district that, let's say, has a high percentage of students in poverty or a high percentage of English language learners or potentially both, you know, they would be able to draw more from the education fund without necessarily having to raise taxes than a district that you know may have far fewer students from economically deprived backgrounds. So ultimately, it's easier to understand when you talk about sort of the money following the student, but it's really about taxing capacity. So in theory, a school board could say, well, with these changes, we now have more equalized pupils, which means our per pupil spending has gone down, which means our tax rate can go down, and they could opt to use this taxing capacity to lower taxes rather than have more money to spend on services.
Gotcha. So going into this now, what is the charge of this summer task force?
Well, we need to talk about this report that was commissioned by the legislature, and I think it was about $100,000 or more to do this report. And it's very academic. It's very scientific. It's very it's not has any bias. It was vetted. It's a high quality academic study. And so, you know, we have to really look at how we're going to take these weighting calculations and integrate them with our equalized pupil calculation. So again, it's a factor within how we determine equalized pupils. It's probably the biggest factor. And then we're going to be looking at a lot of other parts of our education funding system, such as the yield. And we also will, you know, be discussing other ways that we can provide funding for additional needs. So, you know, taxing capacity is one, but then there's also what we currently do for special education, for example, which is categorical aid, which is, you know, money directly sent to a district to provide certain additional services. Transportation aid works that way, for example, that student or school districts get a certain amount of money to spend on transportation. That's not based on their equalized pupils. We're going to need to take a look at sort of various definitions that are used when we talk about students from poverty. You know, school systems have got three different definitions that they work with. There's one for determining free and reduced lunch. There's one that the federal government uses for determining federal aid, which is better known as Title I funding. And then there's the one we use currently to determine the pupil weighting factor for students from poverty. So we're going to need to look at you know, which of those definitions can be used. We'd like to sort of make the system simpler, but we have a complex system, and that's hard. We're going to look at, you know, how do we ensure that students who need extra services are getting those extra services. And that's not just for schools that might be the beneficiaries of more taxing capacity, but really all schools, to make sure that, you know, the whole idea here is that all students in Vermont have equal access to opportunity. And so how do we ensure that happens? We have a very localized education system now, and, you know, our agency of education, its sort of main role is to administer federal funds, and they don't get to spend a lot of time and resources on making sure that our schools are meeting the quality standards that are so important. So we're going to take a look at, you know, the resources that the Agency of Education has in order to make sure that students are, in fact, getting equal opportunity. And then we need to, you know, we'll be looking at other factors within education funding. How do we create a system so that there's sort of tax equity across school districts? You know, again, we have a system where it's 100% funded by the state, but all the spending decisions are local. So therefore, if you're a district that tends to spend more per pupil than other districts, to a certain extent, you are actually subsidized by those lower spending districts, because all of the money flows into one big pot and then is drawn out based on per pupil spending.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're going to look at a lot of this, it's a kind of a big task, a very daunting task.
Yes, it is.
And we have a short time frame to do it. So we have our work cut out for us.
Representative Conlon, we did hear from Frank, and he says the real per pupil budget cost is really the budget divided by students. The weighted business is not the true per pupil cost for taxpayers. And I guess in theory that is correct. So, you know, how does the per pupil weighting fit into that?
The weighting, again, is the main factor in how we determine equalized pupils. And equalized pupils does, in fact, differ from, you know, your pupil count, the average, what we call average daily membership, or the, you know, the enrollment numbers.
Mm-hmm, sure.
In order to reflect the increased cost of certain types of education. And as I said, it's really about, you know, the taxing capacity of a community and drawing funds from the state education fund. So, you know, it because we are a state-funded system, you know, again, I even get lost as I sort of try to work through the machinations in my head.
Sure.
But true education spending, yes, we could say is just the bottom line budget minus the revenues that come in, let's say in tuition or state categorical aid for special ed and transportation, and then, you know, divided by the students. But when it comes to the tax rate that you get, it's really based on how much money you're drawing from the state education fund, and that is based on equalized pupils, the biggest factor of which is how each student is weighted.
And I'm thinking, Representative Conlon, that this would have a more severe impact on a school district that has less students that are in the poverty level or are English language learners, or the other things that would weight them more heavily. Am I right about that?
I would say you were right about that, yes. So if you are a school district that, you know, really is from a wealthier grouping of communities, your pupil weights would not be as high as those who have a lot of students from poverty or English language learners. And there are other factors also that we're looking
at,
such as what we now call rurality or sort of population density, in order to sort of reflect the higher cost that isolated, geographically isolated, small school districts have.
Gotcha. Do many other states use this per pupil weighting system?
Yes. Probably, you know, maybe half do to a certain extent. And, you know, so a lot of the recommendations in the report were based on looking at other states. Vermont, however, has a very unique funding system in that, you know, it's 100% state funded from the education fund. You know, that fund is made up of different revenues, including regular old property taxes on non-residential property, as well as sales tax, rooms and meals tax, and a few others. Other states, by and large, use a mix of, you know, like a base amount from the state and then the rest raised locally. Act 60 and Act 68, which were, you know, laws that came out based on the Brigham decision, really changed how Vermont does things and really led to our statewide funding system.
I know you're on the House Education Committee, but this is a pretty knotty issue to say, you know, to kind of raise your hand and want to be part of during this summer. What is your interest in this particular issue?
Well, you know, the nice thing about this task force is it's not just Education Committee members. It also has members from Ways and Means and from Senate Finance who are really involved in, you know, taxing and how taxes work, and especially in regards to the education fund and property taxes. So they'll sort of be coming at it from that perspective. We'll be coming at it from, you know, sort of that perspective, plus, you know, making sure that all students have equitable access to opportunity. You know, I think that when they were creating this task force, they really wanted to get people on there who had a pretty solid base knowledge in our incredibly complex funding system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been a school board member for 15 years, and I've been on the Education Committee for 5. And I'll just say that every year when we talk about this, I sort of learn or relearn new factors. So it's hard, and I think that the committee was really meant to have people who had at least a good solid base knowledge in this. But those of us even with a base knowledge continually learn the impact of doing one thing or another on how it all melds together. We haven't even started talking about this in relation to special education funding, which is also another complex matter that the state is looking at.
My. When will the committee start to meet?
Well, the what is now a law that was signed in a week or so ago by the governor called for the first meeting to be called by June 1st. But since it hadn't been signed into law yet, that wasn't doable. So we're hoping to get our first meeting in by the end of June. We have a goal of 12 meetings between now and the start of 2022. And, you know, and coming out of that would be recommended legislation for the General Assembly to consider in the 22 session.
Nice. What kind of input will you receive or be asking for from the public?
Well, I think that the law calls for us to have a public comment period before each committee meeting, but then also at least one, or maybe it says at least two, I can't remember which, public forums on this so folks can weigh in. And, you know, there are parts of the state that for this is a very big deal, and, you know, it's really, I think, it's important to hear from all parts of the state. The task force, the folks who are appointed to the task force, really represent a great geographical blend of the state, but we'll be getting a fair amount of public input as we go forward.
As you and I have both admitted this morning, the education tax system is already difficult for most Vermonters to follow, and how it affects the property taxes they pay. This will also take an actuarial degree you know, on the distribution side. So is there going to be a goal of trying to keep things as simple as they possibly can with the recommendations that you make?
I think, you know, there's just always an overarching effort to try to get our school funding system to be simpler than it is and to understand it better than it is. And as complex as it is right now and difficult to understand, it is a pretty fair, progressively taxing system. It's been hard to change because in many ways it's got a lot of good points to it. I think that we would all like to see it be revamped in a way that makes it far more understandable to the average Vermonter.
And then what happens with the recommendations that are made by the task force?
Well, so, you know, the charge to the task force is to come out with proposed legislation, and then that would be introduced and then would go through the full, you know, the full process of the General Assembly, debated in committee, debated on the floor, sent over to the other body, same process, lots of room for testimony and public comment. So, you know, it'll be in many ways sort of a rerun of what the task force will be doing, but in a much more, you know, a lot more hands and eyes on it as it goes through.
And I know you haven't met yet, but Representative Conlon, how confident are you that a clear, concise, passable solution will come out of this task force?
I think we are all on the committee committed to taking these the recommendation that we got in this report that we paid a lot of money for, and to create a system that reflects that to the best extent possible, while also trying to simplify the system a little bit more. So I'm confident we will come out with something. This is a legislative task force, so we are all legislators. We are, you know, this is what we do, and I think that to not do it would be a real letdown to all of our colleagues who passed this bill and assume that we'll get our job done.
Representative Peter Conlon of Cornwall is a member of the House Committee on Education. This summer, he will serve as one of 8 members of a task force studying per-pupil weighting. And Representative Conlon, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Well, you're very welcome, and thanks for your interest in a complex but important topic.
It is indeed. But we do have to talk about this. It hasn't come up in 20 years, so it's good that we're moving forward on this. We're going to pop out and get a CBS News update, and then we'll return for a half hour of open phones. A reminder that the Red Sox finish a wraparound series with the Blue Jays today. Coverage on WDEV begins at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. It also completes the Sox current homestand. And also a reminder that we are going to air the governor's special COVID news conference. That's coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, going on till 11:45. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We've got the phones wide open right now until 10 o'clock. You can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, folks, what's on your mind? Have you been getting back together with friends and family? How's it been? Did you realize you might have missed it more than you were admitting? I had my first get-together on Saturday. There were about a dozen of us, and I'll let you know how it went in a bit. I'm not sure I was ready. It was very talky. You can share what you've been experiencing at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Sox been going through a rougher patch with their starting pitching. It was a strong point for most of the season. Chris Sale, not ready yet, might not be all season. So what happens? Do the Sox become buyers, sellers, sit tight, get what they can out of this season, which so far has been much better than what we would have thought it would this season. But, yeah, that trade deadline starts to come up, and you start to have to think about what to do. Trade away what you got for prospects. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Anybody watching Euro 2000, the soccer championships? Some stuff to talk about there. I've been watching it very, very closely. And then the National Spelling Bee. So our own Jacques Bailey, who's a UVM professor in classics, he reads the words for the participants. I don't know if you knew this. It's something he's been doing since 2003. He's what they call the official pronouncer. And I was watching on Saturday and saw someone, I'll say allegedly, cheat. And it has me a little cheesed, and I'll tell you about that as well. But I contacted the Scripps National Spelling Bee about it. Yeah, I did. It was a sixth grader. Anyway, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We can chat about whatever you'd like. The phones are open now until 10 o'clock. And, all right, so what are we going to talk about first? First of all, getting back together with friends. So I was at a party on Saturday, and a lovely bunch of people. As a matter of fact, quieter than I am, not quite as chatty. And of course I get this, this compulsion to fill the void, right? And, I can be alone in my world, forever. The pandemic was not that much of a strain for me, but boy, put me in front of, some friends, some people. And if I start to get them laughing, I will not stop, right? That's probably my drug, my addiction, right? The sound of laughter, especially when I think I'm creating that laughter. They could be laughing, at me and not with me, but, let's just say I filled the void. And, afterwards, I was thinking about last Tuesday's interview with Lizzie Post from the Emily Post Institute and thinking, here I have her on the show for a half hour. I get to listen to all the ways, you know, how to behave properly when you get back to seeing people again. And I pretty much didn't pay attention to any of it is what I think, happened on Saturday when I went to a party. So, how about you? You all doing all right with it? You know, another time I was out with two other friends. This was several weeks before, and, all three of us, were quite chatty, but we all kind of turned to one another and say, am I talking too much? No. Because we all were going, 100 miles an hour. But I think I might have put a damper on, like, private conversations, small side conversations that were going on. I think I pretty much steamrolled right over them, once I got going and started doing basically what was like a stand-up routine. Oh, my. All right. Well, that's my confession. How are you doing, getting back in to society? 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Or are you still avoiding human contact? That's okay too. I'd love to hear how you're faring. All right, you want to hear about the spelling bee? No one's called yet, so it looks like I'm gonna have to launch into this. I had to bring printouts for this one. All right, so here's what happened. So you watch on a screen, and it's divided into kind of threes, and they just the child, the sixth grader, is sitting there. It's all virtual right now, and this is like the preliminary round. And they were rolling through like Ohio and Kentucky when I watched it. And there's Jacques Bailey, our UVM prof, who does a phenomenal job. I'm a big fan. And he's like, he's got fanboys. You know, he's got fans because of him doing this for 18, 19 years now of being the official pronouncer. But anyway, he comes on, and here's the kid. And they'll get a word to spell, they will get a definition, and then a second word to spell. And they have to make it through all three. If they fail on any of them, that's the end, right? And the idea is you're supposed to have your hands in full view of the camera so that you're not using a device, you're not typing on anything, right? And, you know, Jacques got to worry about that, right? He's got to keep telling them, put the hands up. The audio was not always great on some of the kids, and, you know, they've got these headsets, and he's like, can you move it closer to your mouth? At times, poor Jacques is telling the kid, you're going to have to shout. You're going to have to shout so I can hear you. So the audio quality was not great, which made it that much more difficult. And, you know, there was one kid, I see a couple people back in the corner, and they're kind of peeking around the corner, and it's, I'm thinking, is that legal, you know, but they let it go. And it turned out being his mom and his teacher, and he made it through to the quarterfinals. He qualified. And, I mean, they rushed into the room and hugged him, and mom says, you got to go downstairs and tell everybody downstairs. I mean, it was a special moment. You could just see how great this is. I'm really building this up on the cheater, the alleged cheater. Anyway, this kid failed, and like you would in sixth grade, like the weight of everyone he was, you know, who was counting on him is now on his shoulders, and he just kind of slumped forward, and when he raised his head back up a little, you could see the tears had come. He had failed, and they try to be as kind as possible. Thank you so much, they say, for, you know, the work you've done, the work you've put into preparing. But, you know, you get one wrong, you get one wrong. There was another one, and this one, I almost want to, like, shoot up in flare and say, hey, this is unfair. But, there are words that I was getting, you know, and I don't know the words. There were words I did know and, you know, I was getting. I think I got all of the multiple guess, multiple choice. That's the middle question. You had to tell what the meaning was, but you had three choices. I got all those right. But there was one, and they give this kid a word, of course, that you never heard of before, and it was a resident of one of the Cook Islands, so not the Cook Islands overall, but one of the Cook Islands with a really bizarre name. I'm going to try to find it here. And basically, it was a resident of one of the Cook Islands. So let me see if I can find it. Oh, man, it was brutal. And this kid, like, I would have just said, are you kidding me? Like, who will know what this is? And, you know, I mean, he went down in flames. He spelled it the way I would have spelled it. And it was rough. So anyway, he got that wrong. But this young lady was asked the word twite. Twite. And, you know, you can ask, could you use it in a sentence? You know, what is it? Noun, verb, adjective, you know, other alternative pronunciations, derivation. You can ask all those things. And so she's asking away and asking away. And all of a sudden, like, her hands are not in full view at any point. And I could see her arms moving as if she's typing on a computer in front of her. She's wearing glasses, so the color of the screen changes as if the screen has changed. And she keeps asking Jacques Bailey to, you know, all these questions about twite, which you pretty much have two options, T-W-I-T-E or T-W-I-G-H-T, and it's British derivation. I would have gone with T-W-I-G-H-T. Anyway, she, you know, I see all this happening, and then all of a sudden, and she would also do another thing where she would write it on her hand, which is okay, that's cool, because your hands are now up in front of, it's the only time you saw her hands. And poor Jacques is not saying anything. Anyway, she spelled it T-W-I-T-E, she got it right, but I think she might have cheated. So I went to the website of the Scripps National Spelling Bee, and there is an integrity pledge that the kids have to take. And it says integrity, firm adherence to a code of especially moral or artistic values, incorruptibility, pledge, a binding promise of agreement to do or forbear. And then the integrity pledge is, I am honest to myself. I am fair to my fellow competitors. On my honor, I will neither give nor receive any help during this virtual spelling bee. I did find the word that this poor kid, he was like a dude. He was kind of cool. He had a name like Loyal or Leaper or something funny. But he was given the word, his first word, Loyal, your word is Ida Tatakian. You can just see the face. I'm screaming at my computer screen like, that's not fair. Ida Tatakian. Could you use it in a sentence? It's a resident of one of the Cook Islands, and he spelled it with, you know, started with an I, which I would have. It's A-I-T-U-T-A-K-I-A-N. There, you know it now in case you're in a spelling bee and it comes up. Ida Tatakian. All right. I'm getting good at the pronunciation. All right. So I reached out about what I thought was alleged cheating on the National Spelling Bee on Saturday, and I wrote to Scripps, who sponsors the National Spelling Bee. And my interest, I was really chuffed to see Jock Bailey, who is the pronouncer. He's a UVM classics professor and a great guy. He does an amazing job. If you've never seen it, just tune in just to watch him. And I will tell you that every kid that came up, every single kid, when they come in on the screen, I was rooting for him. I wanted everyone to get it right, and I was really crushed every time they got one wrong. And, you know, it's just what you do. But this young woman, it looked like she was typing and cheating, and so they wrote back. Becca Cochran McCarter wrote to me from the Scripps company. I could not let this go. I was yelling at my screen. I was so upset. She says, thanks for reaching out. Yes, each speller takes an integrity pledge at the start of the Scripps National Spelling Bee. In addition, each speller has a third-party proctor in the room. Now, this I find interesting because some of these kids are sitting there in their bedrooms. But nonetheless, a third-party proctor in the room with them at all times during the virtual elements of the national competition this year. The proctors oversee the speller's participation and verify results to the bee after each speller's turn, whether or not they are successful in advancing in the competition. And there are hundreds of kids doing this, like all across the country. So there are hundreds of proctors sitting there. They got these people out there. More power to Scripps for getting this done. All right, I'm going to get through this. In the particular instance you mentioned, the speller's proctor verified integrity during her turn, and upon an inquiry in real time from the bee, he confirmed the speller was faux typing on the table behind her keyboard, and that he had full view of her hands and screen throughout the turn. As an additional layer, the bee also is using a technology vendor for the virtual elements to create a level playing field and competition space so that every speller has some virtual experience. The vendor provided each speller with the same equipment, laptop and accessories, ahead of the preliminaries and provides the bee with information related to system use during the competition. So apparently it's legit. She did not cheat. I apologize. That's why I keep saying alleged cheater. I just wonder why they keep having poor Jacques Bailey say to the contestants, I need to see your hands. I need to see your hands. Please. He would have them kind of put them hands folded up in front of their face. But he did not on this particular one, and she looked like she was typing away there. But anyway, let's go to Rich in Starksboro. That's the end of my story. It was a long one. Apparently, I did not sniff out cheating, and maybe that's a good thing. Hey, Rich, what's going on?
Oh, not too much, Rick. I was just wondering if you've had a guest in yet to discuss about this year's outbreak of gypsy moths.
I have not. And, okay, Rich, don't go away. Stay with me on this. I had not heard of this until at the party I was at on Saturday night. A friend who's from Milton was going on about it, and she was telling me all about it, telling everybody. And one other person there had any knowledge, you know, oh yeah, we were out at Indian Pond or whatever, and you know, Indian Brook Pond, and there, you know, we saw a lot of gypsy moths. So apparently Milton and Colchester got hit. Yesterday on social media, start to see a lot of pictures of this. Have you experienced it there in Starksboro, Rich?
Not here yet, but they're out on Butler Island quite severely.
Yep, that sounds like it sounds like it's kind of up north, you know, towards the lake. And so do you want to tell people what people have been experiencing so far?
Well, I can tell you a little bit.
Sure.
When we were coming home on the interstate, like you say, around Milton, there was one side of the road that was like totally defoliated.
Right.
And then the other side of the road wasn't. So I guess you could imagine trying to be a caterpillar and trying to make it across two rows of interstate without getting squished. So I guess that's why they're only on one side of the road.
Yeah.
But on Butler Island, our neighbors, if you look down to their place, you can see all the sunshine among the trees, just totally defoliated. And they've moved on to less desirable trees. They've totally defoliated hemlock. So once that gets defoliated, it's over. The hemlock will never recover. And they're doing white cedar trees, which is also not one of their favorites. But I've been reading about them, and they'll do 300 different species of trees and shrubs and stuff.
No kidding.
Keep going. But I think it'd be great to get somebody from like Forest and Parks or from all the Maple Sugar Makers Association or anything like anybody like that to kind of tell us, you know, not too much you can do, I guess, but it'd be good to hear it from the experts instead of, you know, somebody like me who's just kind of an observer.
Yeah. You know? Rich, you are a new de facto producer of the show. I appreciate that. It's funny. I don't know why I didn't put two and two together. I heard that story just this weekend, but I should have been at least making a note to get somebody on the show, and we definitely do need to. So it's a brilliant idea. Maybe I think we have some open phones tomorrow. We'll ask people what they've been seeing. But you see a lot of leaf litter. You see a lot of dead caterpillars on the road. People are walking over them, but the gypsy moths have really hit a specific area of Vermont and defoliating. That's exactly what they're doing right now, defoliating large swaths of our forests. Rich, great call. Thank you
so much. Our neighbor out there on Butler Island, they go on. I guess I've lost you. Okay. Sounds like it.
All right, Rich, I got to go. Thanks. All right. All right, take care. All right. That's it for Open Phones. I do appreciate that call, Rich. You're spot on. We got to get somebody on here to talk about gypsy moths. We're going to hear the CBS News, then be back to learn about the monument. It was created and performed by students at NVU Johnson and received a national award. And coming up today after the midday news service, we'll have Greg Hooker in here, 3 hours of The Getaway. And don't forget the governor coming up at 11 o'clock. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, Ida Tatakian, that's the word. Ida.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Kids these days. Yeah, let me tell you about some of them. Like the group of college students at NVU Johnson who decided to write and perform The Monument. I could spend time telling you all about it, but I've got plenty of guests who would love to do just that. Joining me are several of the creators and performers of the piece. And so we'll start by introducing them. Addison White. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Rebecca Handley, great to have you on the show.
That's great to be on the show. Thank you.
James Stoll, thank you for being here as well.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Excellent. And joining us is Isaac Eddy. He is assistant professor and chair of performing arts at NVU Johnson. Good morning, Isaac.
Good morning, Rick. We are so appreciative to have this time with you. Thanks a lot for having me.
It is great to have you all. I do, before we start, though, I have to hand out kudos to our director, Dandy McGivergan. He is running the board over there, getting the news on and commercials, and got all four of you lined up in record time. So it's great to have you all, and so great that Danny was able to do that. Now, listeners, if you want to ask a question about the monument, it's going to be a little goofy here, but we'll do our best to work you in. The monument is about women's suffrage movement in Vermont, and you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Might be easier to email this morning, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Isaac, I'm going to start with you. First of all, tell me about this group who created the production. Is it a club, a class assignment, a group of theater students? Who are they?
Yes, so this is the very first devised production, and devised meaning it was created, it's an original piece created by the ensemble itself. It's the very first devised production of our brand new performing arts program called Performance Arts and Technology. And the focus of this new program is multidisciplinary creation of new works by students. So instead of just having theater students study theater and music students study music and dance students study dance and design students studying design, all of them are in the same room together, learning from each other and allowing the other fields to inform their own field. So we had an ensemble of designers, writers, directors, dancers, and actors all create this piece together. There was 9 ensemble members and myself.
Wow.
And it was last fall where we got together. We met over Zoom. The entire team was over Zoom, 3 hours a night, Monday through Thursday for most of the semester. And we did a lot of research on the suffrage movement, and then we created this original piece called The Monument.
They may be called upon by, like, government agencies to figure out how to perform, you know, this kind of a task and come up with great results for how they were able to do this. Addison, I'm going to start with you. You've got the big question now. So I'm going to ask you to explain to everyone the basic premise of The Monument.
So The Monument is essentially a Zoom meeting in a small Vermont town, and we are deciding whether or not to keep our old monument or have a new one. And we really wanted to incorporate so many of the things that are going on in our world right now or at the time, because we felt like it was important to have it be on Zoom, because, you know, the world was on Zoom at that time.
Yeah.
And it was, and there was just so much going on in terms of social justice as well. We were kind of having this reckoning, and we just thought it was important to include all of those aspects in our performance.
And this will be almost like a time capsule for what 2020 was, what 2020 was, when you watch this in the future, because as you watch this Zoom meeting, there are dogs barking, there are kids crying, there are people going on and off the screen. One person, I think it was played by Isaac Eddy, is walking around driving you nuts, you know, with their laptop, and you're seeing all through their house. So it is a true representation, I will tell you that, of what it's like to be in a Zoom meeting in 2020. The town, the fictitious Vermont town, is Waldenburg. And Rebecca, why was the idea of the suffrage movement in Vermont chosen as the idea for this performance?
We wanted to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the right for women to, or for women to receive the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that starting in Vermont would make the play a little bit more relatable, because I don't think a lot of Vermonters actually know about the suffrage movement. You know, we think of all of these great suffragists like Susan B. Anthony and Isma Holland, and we don't really realize that that was also a big part of Vermont history in the 1920s. And we just wanted to make this play to kind of let people know that it's really only been 100 years, and this was part of our history, and especially with the previous recent election, we really wanted people to take the time to get out there and vote.
Now, James Stoll, I know nine of you sat down to create this thing, so logistically, that sounds like an absolute nightmare. How were you able to work together with a group of nine people to come up with what you did? It was easy, right?
It was easy in the sense that we in like a class structure. So, like there was time specifically set up to meet. It was all on Zoom, so it wasn't too hard to get everyone together to basically get all this done, but it certainly took a long day, a long night.
So let me get this straight, James. You met on Zoom to create a Zoom production?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, it sounds kind of goofy, but I guess that's what we do in 2020 and now 2021. Isaac, as this process was unfolding, what was your role? What role did you play?
I was primarily the facilitator. I technically, on the playbill, my title is director. But one thing that is I focus on as a theater director is to really try to flatten the hierarchy. And by that, I mean it's not me being the final say on what goes and what doesn't. I'm just a collaborator along with everyone else, all of the other ensemble members. So I initially brought, for the first few weeks, I brought specific exercises and specific framing for how we could approach the material and gave them mini assignments on creating many characters and many pieces that we could then stitch together. But then after that, I was just a collaborator along with everyone else. And I would sometimes step out and ask pointed questions. What does this mean if we approach it this way? Have you thought about this? What are we forgetting? Are we not recognizing enough of the BIPOC suffragists that were so important in the history? You know, those type of questions.
Yeah.
But primarily, I was just a collaborator along with all the students.
I mean, were there times where you kind of had to hold back, where you thought, I want to jump in, I want to steer them, I want to provide guidance, but you thought, at this point, it's best to just let them create?
Yeah, that is such an important question for folks, for educators in the arts, and especially in the performing arts. And I would like to say that I always was able to step back, but the problem was, and the three students on the call know this too, it gets to a point where it's so exciting that I could not add my own stuff to it. And thankfully, a lot of times I would offer up stuff and I was just another person offering ideas and they're like, no, it doesn't really work. I'm like, okay.
Wow. You got shot down.
Yes. In the most supported way possible.
Yeah.
And honestly, this is a big part of this program is learning how critical thinking, communication, and collaboration, right? Mm-hmm. And that is applicable for any type of profession, any type of good human interaction that these students are going to engage in for the rest of their lives. So if they can supportively shoot me down, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, brilliant. And let's just look at the timeline, Isaac. How long did this take? When did they form, and then when was this completed?
So we, we started in September, and then we met for, I believe, 11 weeks, and that was Monday through Thursday, 6 to 9 p.m., and we had off-center theater based in Burlington. We had a dramaturg and a writer from that group who are working on their own suffrage play come and advise us during the time. We pitched some ideas to them. They gave us some ideas, and then we did a performance, a kind of dry run for them, and they gave us great notes. And then we wrapped it all up right around Election Day
No kidding.
Early November.
Wow.
And then we were chosen, the production was chosen to be presented at Region 1 Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival, which happened in January. And then we just got word about a week ago that we won a national award from the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival.
Yes.
A Citizen Artist Award.
All right, we're going to get to those. Hold on there, Isaac. We're going to get to those awards.
Okay.
And that's what called this to my attention. You know, it's unfortunate. This is a brilliant piece, and it's fortunate. I have to a national award has to be given to you all for me to recognize the work you've done. But sometimes we just don't find out about things until something like this happens. And, you know, that's the reason you're all here. Okay, I'm going to ask each of you to briefly describe the characters in the play, The Monument, that you played. And, Addison, I'm going to start with you. So go right ahead and tell us who you played.
So the character I created is named Ellowyn LeGrew, and she's kind of this hippie gardener lady, and I based her on a lot of the people that I grew up around and that raised me, basically. And it was really fun to kind of draw from those typical Vermont experiences that I had when creating this character. And kind of make it my own.
I do have to ask you this. I really got obsessed with this, Addison. You have to drink a lot of herbal tea in your role. Did that cause any logistical problems for you?
Yes. So I basically had this massive mason jar with tea bags and lemon and like a bunch of different stuff in it. And then I would drink the whole thing throughout the course of the show, and then right as Curtain Call was happening, I would run to the bathroom super quick and then race back so I could be back on screen in time. But yeah, that was just a fun touch that I thought would really add to the character.
Suffering for your art. Rebecca, next tell us who you played.
My character was Mary Jane Smith, and she was the artist hired by the co-chair of the Waldenburg Town Select Board. And Mary Jane was asked to design a statue for the Green, and it was going to replace the statue of Governor Percival Clemens, who was the Vermont governor in the 1920s, and he was very much against the women's right to vote. He voted against it. So that was sort of the main conflict in the play, was this statue that Mary Jane Smith had designed, and if it was representative of all women, and if Percival Clemens' statue was supposed to be taken down. She was a really fun character to play.
Are you an artist?
I am. I was actually, when we were in the class, I was painting a mural, and a lot of, I think for like 4 weeks every Tuesday, I was plugged into the class through my headphones while I was painting this mural, and that's how I got the idea for my breakout room. So we thought it would be cool, since I was kind of doing a live painting while we were taking the class, that my breakout room would be a live painting too.
Well, I should
which
tell
made my job easier.
Yeah, I should tell listeners that Rebecca has to present, you know, her monument to this committee and to townspeople, and it is a lesson in life how committees can be soul crushing when it comes to critiquing art. So, all right,
so
James.
Soul crushing.
Yeah, I get it. James, as the only male, you get the role of the tone deaf misogynist. Was that a difficult role to play for you? And tell us about the role, first of all.
I played Chair James, who was the head of the Select Board Committee. He's obsessed with Governor Clement and the ball in Waldenburg. It is, as you said, conservative and also that. I will say I did not find it hard to play it, but I am not like that. It's knowing how to play the opposite of basically what I think.
Yeah, right. Well, you did a good job with it, and you know you want to stretch yourself as an actor, so well done. Now I'm going to do this for just a moment. I hate to take any spotlight off the play and the students, but Isaac, I do want you to briefly tell us about your time with the Blue Man Group.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, so I performed full time with Blue Man for 12 and a half years, over 4,000 shows. And I was the cast captain in New York City for 8 years. I got to perform the show for 2.5 years on the Strip in Las Vegas, opened the show in London, and train Blue Man, audition Blue Man, direct certain pieces, help write new content. So I got this wonderful exposure to professional theater, not just from an acting standpoint, but from a production standpoint and from all these other levels. And I realized doing that I got just as much energy from teaching others and directing as I did from being on stage myself. And so I was working with the Governors Institute on the Arts here in Vermont, where I grew up, and coming back every summer to teach there made me realize I wanted to pursue that more than being a Blue Man. So I got my master's in the performance and interactive media arts, and then a teaching position opened up here at NBU Johnson, and it was only for a year position, but thankfully got switched to tenure track. And then I've been teaching here for 6 years, and I just got tenure
wonderful.
This past year.
Wow, you have a lot to celebrate. A quick question.
Yes, exactly.
Do the students ever insist a solo Blue Man performance from you?
My students make fun of me. It's almost like back at band camp. I always have Blue Man anecdotes, and sometimes it's helpful in the classroom, but other times they're like, you know what? I think we need to get back to what we're doing here.
Well done, students. Addison, the first honor this play received was to perform it for others, and Isaac had been telling us about that, but why don't you tell us more about all about that?
Wait, sorry. Can you repeat that really quick?
Sure. So your first honor was this play was chosen to be performed or shown for others. I think it was the Cape Cod group.
Oh, yes. So we performed our original performance, like I just said, around Election Day. And we had our feedback session. We found out, I think, about a week later that we were going to perform it and that we were nominated for the award. And it was really, really special because we were able to come together and, like, make some last-minute edits and, like, really make it perfect. And we kind of got this, like, opportunity that you don't usually get with plays to, like, refine it and do the things that you wish you had done the first time around.
Sure.
And it was really, really great to be able to make those edits and share it with a larger audience.
Oh, that's brilliant. Rebecca, then the National Award. So what was that? Tell us about the National Award you just received.
Oh, my gosh. the performance itself or just receiving the award?
Yeah, receiving the award.
It was so mind-boggling because when you're behind a computer, it takes a little bit to hit you versus when you're on a stage.
Right.
And this national award is a huge honor to receive, and for our little tiny school in our little tiny state to be recognized for that was just. It was such a surreal experience, and to be part of that was just even more humbling, I think.
Mm. And James, now it was the Kennedy Center Citizen Artist Award. James, when you all started working on this in September, did you have any idea it would be so well received?
Honestly, I don't think we knew how well received it would be. I mean, we had an idea of where it was going and that it would probably be okay, but we had, I don't think we had any idea that we would get this, any of this.
Isaac, what is next for the monument?
That is a great question. I think if technically this is part of the program is that we create these original pieces and then we publish them on our own and they are available for other people to pick up. So that's kind of where it's at right now. But it was such a special piece that my hope is that the ensemble, we all keep in touch still over Facebook Messenger, and which is, I typically will keep in touch with ensembles that have that we've created shows before, but there's something special about this ensemble with what we've created. And so my hope is that we are able to revive it and do it again in some form, either with this ensemble or have it be available to be performed by others.
And how can people watch it?
It is currently available on YouTube.
YouTube. All right. And just go in and search The Monument, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Addison White, Rebecca Hanley, James Stolt are three of the students from NVU Johnson who wrote and performed the award-winning The Monument. Isaac Eddy, assistant professor and chair of performing arts at NVU Johnson. I want to thank you all for being on the program together. Congratulations. This was a lot like The Monument, like the Zoom call. All of you there. So we kind of recreated it in miniature this morning. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Bye now. All right, let's take a break. CBS News Update is next. Then we'll be back to hear about something cool happening at the Charlotte Library. And coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, the Governor's COVID Response News Conference is a special one. So we'll be tuned into that here on WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. One institution that I am so happy that has endured is our libraries. Some people are chronic library users. Others have used them at points in their lives when they've needed them for specific research or materials, from books to audiobooks to online accessibility. Somehow, these institutions have reinvented themselves to meet our changing needs. And then there's the architecture of so many of the libraries here in Vermont that make them a destination themselves when we're visiting another town. Well, this morning, we're turning our attention to the Charlotte Public Library to learn about the programs that they've got going on there. And we're going to zone in on one in particular, their Seed Library. Joining me for the next half hour to remind us how cool libraries can be is Linda Hamilton. She's the Seed Library Coordinator. Linda, thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Margaret Woodruff, she is the Director of the Charlotte Public Library. And Margaret, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask our guests a question about the Charlotte Library or about the Seed Library, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Margaret, give us a little overview of the Charlotte Public Library.
All right. Well, we are located in Charlotte, Vermont, which is pretty sure everybody knows where we are, but just in case, south of Burlington at the edge of Chittenden County, in a town of about 3,700 people. And I feel very grateful that our town has been very supportive of our library and allowed us to do some new and innovative things, such as the Seed Library that you mentioned. And particularly exciting for us is we just finished a renovation project last March. And especially exciting is that we were able to reopen last week to the public, so people could finally come in and see our new space.
That is exciting. How long has your library been serving Charlotte?
The library here, there was a community library up at the school for a number of years that started in the 80s, I believe. And the library here where we are located opened in 1998.
Gotcha. Now, Linda, when did the Seed Library become part of the lineup of offerings at the Charlotte Public Library?
Oh, about 5 or 6 years ago. And started very small, and it just has been gaining momentum as people have responded to it, and we've evolved based on that interest.
Where did the original idea come from?
Well, there is around the world a network of seed savers and seed libraries. And Margaret picked up on this several years ago, 5, 6 years ago. And so we have not invented anything new. We're part of a network of repositories of seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And at first you might think, well, what's the connection between seeds and a library, a public library?
You're reading my mind, Margaret.
Well, just as a public library is a repository of information and knowledge, and it promotes the circulation of that knowledge, the sharing of it, so too a seed library promotes a repository of genetic biological diversity represented in heritage seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And promotes and facilitates the sharing of that, the circulation of that, the maintaining those seeds and then getting them out and planted and into their life cycle again so that they can keep going around and around, because that's the only way seeds stay alive is if we grow them out and they produce more seeds.
Yeah. Well, Margaret, when you first heard of it, I mean, did the synapses just fire like that? And you said, ooh, Seed Library, Charlotte Public Library, because it sounds like a little bit of a reach other than the word library in there. Did you have that immediate buy-in, or did you have to be convinced?
No, I'd have to say it was pretty immediate. I think that one commonality for me throughout all the resources that libraries offer is the sharing of information. And as Linda described, it is that information, you know, in seeds. And then as Linda and Karen, the other seed library coordinator, have done such a wonderful job of is using those seeds and the seed library as a stepping stone to offer more information about how people can make the best use of those seeds. So, but right from the get-go, it seemed like an automatic connection and a way for us to continue to foster our connections with the community.
Well, Margaret, as I mentioned in my introduction there, that libraries have really had to be nimble well before the pandemic, mm-hmm. reimagine their roles, offering to
yep.
the public. So what are some other ways that the Charlotte Public Library has done that?
Well, let's see. Sort of coupled with the seed library is we've increased our focus on food-related programs. So we have sort of some more entertaining kinds of things, such as we have a cookbook book club where we all pick a cookbook and then share dishes from that at a potluck supper.
That's brilliant.
Hasn't happened since the pandemic, but we're looking forward to starting up again.
For someone who loves to eat like me, that is the most brilliant thing I've ever heard, but keep going.
Oh, well, thanks. And then related to that, we recently received a grant last summer for a Charlie Cart portable kitchen, and this will allow us to do some more food-related programming, food literacy, using coupling with the Seed Library is sort of highlighting local foods that we can all enjoy, and we're looking forward to partnering with the Charlotte Food Shelf as well to sort of highlight some of the items that might be made available through the food shelf and, you know, what are fun and easy ways to cook those up.
Nice. Linda, what did it take to set up the Seed Library?
Oh, we're very simple. It's not complicated. Oh, yeah. That was the easy part, really. But, well, the physical Seed Library is very small. It consists of just a little old-fashioned library card file. Remember the drawers?
I do.
Pull out
the Dewey Decimal System.
The Dewey Decimal System on the card. Okay, so we were able to find a small one of those chest of drawers, and in there we keep small packets or packets of a small number of seeds of the varieties that we're stocking and promoting each year. So physically in the library, there's that little chest of drawers. But our program sort of exists in the ether. The mission of the Seed Library is to support people growing at least some of their own food. We know that many people cannot grow all of their own food, but many people can grow some of their own food. And to do it in eco-friendly ways that promote healthy soil, because now we're appreciating more the strong importance of healthy soil,
right,
as the basis of pretty much a lot of things, and in ways that preserve biodiversity, because that gives us the ability to adapt and be more resilient in terms of the food crops that we can produce. And so that means using heritage seeds. And heritage seeds or heirloom seeds are those that are open pollinated, and the seeds will bear plants just like the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a distinction from hybrid seeds, which are the result of cross-pollination between two different varieties, and you get a hybrid. And this is very commonly done, and these seeds are available commercially. But you have to keep buying those seeds again, because if you plant a seed from a hybrid, it will not grow out true to its parent plant. So heirlooms and heritage seeds are extremely important and very easy to lose if we don't keep growing them out and, of course, eating, enjoying the fruits and the vegetables that come out of them. But keeping them going is very important. So we also help people learn how to save seeds for themselves, so that they can replant themselves and they can share with others. So each year we offer a set of varieties, and people can, just like when they go to the regular library, they can borrow a pack of seeds and grow it out. And then when they save some in the fall, they can return seeds to the Seed Library. And around we go.
How many people are using the Seed Library?
Well, this year I think we had about 30.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. It has ticked up each year. And people are beginning to get better at saving the seeds, learning how to save the seeds, and returning them to us.
Margaret, summer was always an exciting time for me as a kid to get to our public library. Is that still the case for younger readers?
Absolutely. And I'm so excited that this year we're finally able to sort of get back to our traditional summer reading programs. Our youth services librarian has lined up a great menu of things for kids to do, and we have, you know, a batch of new books coming in. Kids can keep track of their reading if they want to, but if they just like to enjoy it, we look forward to welcoming them back here, for sure. So, yeah, it still is a big part of what we do. And I think our new space is going to allow us to do an even better job of that.
The library just reopened last Monday. How were you operating up until then?
We were operating, the building itself was closed, but we did what we called porch pickup. A lot of other libraries called curbside delivery, so people could call or email or access their account online, reserve books, and then we would check them out, clean them off, wrap them up, and put them out on our porch for people to swing by and pick up.
And now that you're reopened, are there still any restrictions in place?
Yes, the library board decided that they would like to keep the mask restriction in place at least through the end of this month. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of taking it on a month-by-month basis, but we are asking everybody to wear masks when they come into the library right now.
Linda Hamilton talking about the Seed Library. The one thing I absolutely love about your Seed Library is your catalog. So let's start, first of all, with the size of it. How many different types of seeds are available?
Well, it does vary year to year. And that's on purpose because we want to introduce people to varieties of peppers, let's say, that they may not be familiar with. So each year the catalog has, I'm looking here now, it's just maybe 30 different varieties of, you know, the familiar cast of characters, tomatoes and beans and different lettuces and peppers and beets and carrots. And we are beginning to see people, as I said before, be able to save seeds that they acquire from the seed library. And when they grow them out, then they have saved seeds and they can return them. So we'll restock those, and seeds will hold for a few years. Mm-hmm. The germination rate goes down a bit, but we can hold on to the seeds that we have for, 3 years at least.
And then there's...
So it's not enough. It's not a complete array to plant a whole garden.
Right.
And it's not enough seeds in each packet to maybe give you all of the beans you want for the year. So it's more like a tasting menu.
I love it.
So that you have a chance to try things.
Oh, that sounds even more enticing. Yeah, you certainly know how to market it perfectly, Linda. And there's these fantastic categories. And I want you to tell people about this, where you let gardeners of all levels know how easy it is to plant and to harvest the seeds. It's genius.
Well, and we intentionally aim our programs. We do several programs a year. So maybe probably every other month we have something going in their educational programs. And we mix it up between technical support. You know, what is eco-friendly gardening? What is no-till gardening? What is permaculture? And we do courses and book studies, so that people feel their confidence is building in terms of how to identify pests or avoid diseases and work with the soil. So we do that technical support through educational programs. But then also we branch it out. We think of the Seed Library as a pretty large umbrella. And basically to encourage people to think about where their food comes from, because that's extremely important. Yep. And there are a lot of things tied to that, a lot of aspects of where their food comes from. And they can participate in the miracle of growing some of their own food. And it's so satisfying when you walk out in the morning and pick, you know, peas from your own vines and just eat them right there in the garden.
Yeah. Oh, when that first pepper pops out, or you can go grab basil and make your own pesto right there with your dinner. It really is phenomenal. Margaret, we've talked about the resources and programs that Charlotte Library, Public Library, has been offering, but what are some events that are happening at the library?
Well, let's see. All our events this year will be happening outdoors for the most part, just in keeping with ongoing COVID guidelines. We hope to be emerging out from under that soon. Last Thursday, we had the kickoff for our Grange on the Greens event. We're partnering with Charlotte Grange to host some musical evenings that also feature local farmers. And so people were invited to bring a picnic supper, or we pick up a pizza or a sandwich and join us on the town green for some music and good socially distanced company. We have two kids events coming up in the next couple of weeks. We have Very Merry Theater, which will be performing here on the town green as well. And then we have the Vermont Institute of Natural Science will be doing a kids program to kick off our summer reading program. So we're excited about those events for sure.
Bet. Margaret, do you find that the Seed Library and other programs like that and these events create a stronger bond between the library and the Charlotte community?
Oh, definitely. I think certainly brings in people who might not feel that that the library would be a place they would want to come. And I think it also expands everybody's idea of what a library could offer. And in fact, we've had people come to programs and then say, you know, I've always had an idea for a program about paper making, and I came to this program for the Seed Library, and it made me think maybe you'd be interested in doing this other kind of program. And so I think it's really a great way for us to expand what we offer and connect to the community.
I love it.
What it's all about.
Linda, who can participate in the Seed Library?
Oh, everyone. There's no charge for the seeds, and we've had people from neighboring towns participate, and that's fine. We even had one woman write to us from Charlotte. Is it North Carolina?
Yes, North Carolina.
Oh, I love it. She found us on the web, and she thought we were in her state. She didn't realize we were in Vermont. So that was a little trickier. But, yes, it's available to anyone. We have a range of people, brand-new gardeners, young, to very experienced gardeners, all ages and family situations.
Yeah, oh, I love it.
Wide open.
I know from also searching the web, theirs is called the Charlotte Mecklenburg Library. Linda Hamilton is the Seed Library Coordinator. Margaret Woodruff is the Charlotte Public Library Director. And to learn more about what's happening at the library, to learn about the Seed Library, go to charlottepubliclibrary.org. Linda, Margaret, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, take care. All right, that's our show for today. We're going to have the governor's press conference coming up just after CBS News here on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.